Tim, alcoholic. Thanks, guys. We're on page 182 tonight. We are in a cycle where we're going to read all of the pioneers, the stories in the back of the book of all of the pioneers. And tonight we're going to be hearing the story of Bill Dotson, and he is AA number 3. So Bill goes to Akron, he gets Dr. Bob sober, and what they decide is, we got to keep this thing going. And this is the first successful person that heard the message and followed, not their first try, first successful. Okay, again, 182. Alcoholics Anonymous, number 3, pioneer member of Akron's group number 1, the first AA group in the world. He kept the faith. Therefore, he and countless others found a new life. One of 5 children, I was born on a Kentucky farm in Carlisle County. My parents were well-to-do people, and their marriage was a happy one. My wife, a Kentucky girl, came with me to Akron, where I completed my course in law at the Akron Law School. My case is rather unusual in one respect. There were no childhood episodes of unhappiness to account for my alcoholism. I had, seemingly, just a natural affinity for grog. My marriage was happy, and I never had any of the reasons, conscious or unconscious, which are often given for drinking. Yet, as my record shows, I did become an extremely serious case. Before my drinking had cut me down completely, I achieved a considerable measure of success, having been a city councilman for 5 years and a financial director of a suburb later taken into the city itself. So Bill Dotson obviously is an attorney. And not only was he a councilman for 5 years, but after he got sober, he actually ran again for city councilman and lost. And one of the reasons he lost was the opponent brought up his alcoholism. One of the reasons. But of course, this all went down the drain with my increased drinking. So at the time Dr. Bob and Bill came along, I had about run out of my strength. So that sounds like a bottom to me. The first time that I became intoxicated, I was 8 years old. This was no fault of my father or mother, as they were both very much opposed to drinking. A couple of hired hands were cleaning out the barn on the farm, and I was riding to and fro on the sled. And while they were loading, I drank hard cider out of a barrel in the barn. On the return trip, after 2 or 3 loads, I passed out and had to be carried to the house. I remember that my father kept whiskey around the house for medical purposes and entertainment, and I would drink from this when no one was about and then water it to keep my parents from knowing I was drinking. This continued until I enrolled in State University, and at the end of the 4 years, I realized that I was a drunk. Morning after morning, I awoke sick and with terrible jitters. But there was always a flask of liquor sitting on the table beside my bed. I would reach over and get this and take a shot in a few moments, get up and take another one, shave, eat my breakfast, slip a half pint of liquor in my hip pocket, and go on to school. Between classes, I would run down to the washroom, take enough to steady my nerves, and then go on to the next class. This was in 1917, so we see where this is going if you're a historian, right? So this is also going to tell us that he is approximately the same age as Bill, because they are both of enlistment age. So I left the university in the latter part of my senior year and enlisted in the Army. So the difference here was Bill was a commissioned officer and Bill W. was a commissioned officer. And Bill Dotson is enlisting in the Army, right? At the time, I called it patriotism. Later, I realized that I was running from alcohol, trying to do a geographic. It did help to a certain extent, since I found myself in places where I could not obtain anything to drink, and so broke the habitual drinking. Then prohibition came into effect, and the stuff obtainable was so horrible and sometimes deadly, and that I had married and had a job which I had to look after, helped me for a period of some 3 or 4 years, although I would get drunk every time I could get hold of enough to drink to get started. So what he's referring to there is once Prohibition was on, everybody and his brother was creating booze and not always to the standards that are acceptable. My wife and I belonged to some bridge clubs, and they began to make wine and serve it. However, after two or three trials, I found this was not satisfactory because they did not serve enough to satisfy me, so I would refuse to drink. This problem was soon solved, however, as I began to take my bottle along with me and hide it in the bathroom or in the shrubbery outside. As time went on, my drinking became progressively worse. I would be away from my office 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Probably not a good thing for an attorney to do. 2 or 3 weeks at a time. Horrible days and nights when I would lie on the floor of my home and reach over and get the bottle, take a drink, and then go back into oblivion. During the first 6 months of 1935, I was hospitalized 8 times for intoxication and shackled to the bed 2 or 3 days before I even knew where I was. So here's the end. Here's the end of his torture. On June 26th, 1935, I came in the hospital, and to say I was discouraged is to put it mildly. Each of the 7 times I had left this hospital in the previous 6 months, I had come out fully determined in my own mind that I would not get drunk again for at least 6 or 8 months. It hadn't worked out that way, and I didn't know what the matter was and did not know what to do. I was moved into another room that morning, and there was my wife. I thought to myself, well, she is going to tell me this is the end, and I certainly couldn't blame her and did not intend to try to justify myself. She told me that she had been talking to a couple of fellows about drinking. I resented this very much until she informed me that they were a couple of drunks just as I was. That wasn't so bad to tell it to another drunk. She said, "You are going to quit." That was worth a lot, even though I did not believe it. Then she told me that these two drunks she had been talking to had a plan whereby they thought they could quit drinking, and part of that plan was that they tell it to another drunk. This was going to help them stay sober. All the other people who had talked to me wanted to help me, and my pride prevented me from listening to them and caused only resentment on my part. But I felt as if I would be a real stinker if I did not listen to a couple of fellows for a short time, if that would cure them. So you see that shift there. Every time Bill tried to get somebody sober prior to Dr. Bob, it was always under the premise, I'm going to go save them. And it wasn't until he was pacing the floor of the Mayflower Hotel that he goes and says, I'm going to have to reach out to help somebody to help myself. That's a major shift. And Bill Dotson's proving that right there, that that's already the premise between Dr. Bob and Bill. My wife also told me that I could not pay them even if I wanted to and had the money, which I did not. They came in and began to give me instruction in the program that later became known as Alcoholics Anonymous. There was not much of it at that time. I looked up, and there were 2 great big fellows, over 6 foot tall, very likable looking. I knew afterwards that the 2 who came in were Bill W. and Dr. Bob. Before very long, we began to relate some incidents of our drinking, and pretty soon I realized that both of them knew what they were talking about, and that's what separates us from any other person that reaches out to an alcoholic to help, is the fact that we're talking from experience, not from learned information. Because you can see things and smell things when you're drunk that you can't other times. If I had thought they didn't know what they were talking about, I wouldn't have been willing to talk to them at all. After a while, Bill said, meaning Bill D, Well, now, you've been talking a good long time. Let me talk a minute or two. So after hearing some more of my story, he turned around and said to Doc, I don't think he knew I heard him, but I did. He said, well, I believe he's worth saving and working on. They said to me, do you want to quit drinking? It's none of our business about your drinking. We're not up here trying to take any of your rights or privileges away from you, but we have a program whereby we think we can stay sober. Part of that program is that we take it to someone else who needs it and wants it. Now, if you don't want it, we'll not take up your time, and we'll be going and looking for someone else. The next thing they wanted to know was if I thought I could quit on my own accord without any help, if I could just walk out of the hospital and never take another drink. If I could, that was wonderful and was just fine, and they would very much appreciate a person who had that kind of power. But they were looking for a man who knew he had a problem and knew he couldn't handle it himself and needed outside help. The next thing they wanted to know was if I believed in a higher power. I had no trouble there because I had never actually ceased to believe in God and had tried lots of times to get help but hadn't succeeded. Next, they wanted to know, would I be willing to go to this higher power and ask for help, calmly and without any reservations? They left this with me to think over, and I lay there on that hospital bed and went back over and reviewed my life. I thought of what liquor had done to me, the opportunities that I had discarded, the abilities that I had been given me, and how I had wasted them. And I finally came to the conclusion that if I didn't want to quit, I certainly ought to want to, and that I was willing to do anything in the world to stop drinking. All right, so let's watch him take steps 1, 2, and 3. I was willing to admit to myself that I had hit bottom, key ingredient, that I had gotten hold of something that I didn't know how to handle myself. So this implies powerlessness, right? But he's going to do it more cleanly. So after reviewing these things and realizing what liquor had cost me, I went to this higher power that, to me, was God, without any reservation, and admitted that I was completely powerless over alcohol. So he knew his life was unmanageable, and he knew he was powerless over booze, and that I was willing to do anything in the world to get rid of that problem. In fact, I admitted that from then on, I was willing to let God take over instead of me. Each day, I would try to find out what his will was and try to follow that, rather than trying to get him to always agree that the things I thought up for myself were the things best for me. So when they came back, I told them. So that basically, from the powerless over alcohol in the middle of the paragraph there to that line, is him taking steps 2 and 3. So 1, 2, and 3, right by the middle of 187. One of the fellows, I think it was Doc, said, well, you want to quit? I said, yes, Doc, I would like to quit, at least for 5, 6, or 8 months. So he doesn't quite understand the concept of once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Until I get things straightened up and begin to get the respect of my wife and some other people back and get my finances fixed up and so on. And they both laughed very heartily and said, that's better than you've been doing, isn't it? Which, of course, was true. They said, we've got some bad news for you. It was bad news for us, and it will probably be bad news for you. Whether you quit 6 days, months, or years, if you go out and take a drink or two, you'll end up in this hospital tied down, just like you've been in these past 6 months. You are an alcoholic. As far as I know, that was the first time I had ever paid any attention to that word. I figured I was just a drunk. And they said, no, you have a disease, and it doesn't make any difference how long you do without it. After a drink or two, you'll end up just like you are now. That certainly was very disheartening news at the time. The next question they asked was, you can quit 24 hours, can't you? I said, sure, yes, anybody can do that for 24 hours. They said, that's what we're talking about, just 24 hours at a time. That sure did take a load off my mind. Every time I'd start thinking about drinking, I would think of the long, dry years ahead without having a drink. But this idea of 24 hours, that was up to me from then on, was a lot of help. I didn't read that so well, sorry. At this point, the editors intrude just long enough to supplement Bill D's account, that of the man on the bed. So the reference there is, many of you have probably seen it, it's the famous painting where it shows Bill and Bob next to the bed, the hospital bed, and the guy lying in the bed. Bill Dotson is the guy in the bed. So let me do that again. Just long enough to supplement Bill D's account, that of the man on the bed, with that of Bill W., the man who sat by the side of the bed, says Bill W., 19 years ago last summer, Dr. Bob and I saw Bill D. for the first time. Bill lie on his hospital bed and looked at us in wonder. So just to get our math here correct, Bill D.'s story didn't appear in the first edition. There's some debate on why he didn't write the story. I won't give you some of the theories on why he didn't write the story because I don't believe that they're true. The one that I do believe is true, Akron didn't have the same sort of passion for the book that we did here in New York. They were a little bit more low-key about it. It was a little bit more of a spiritual gig. So the idea of book and selling and that stuff didn't sat well with Bill D. at first. So this is Bill's story appeared in the second edition in 1955. So Bill, in fact, didn't even write his own story. Bill D. didn't write his own story. Bill Wilson went to Akron somewhere in 52 or 53 and interviewed Bill D. And from the interview, this story is written, but with Bill D's permission. So then ultimately, Bill D dies in 54. That obit is going around. Dies in 54. He's born in 1892. Dies in 1954 at age 62. And has approximately 19 years sobriety. That's where that came from. Was that a long tangent? So 2 days before this, Dr. Bob had said to me, if you and I are going to stay sober, we had better get busy. This is Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson talking together. Straight away, Bob called Akron City Hospital. So Dr. Bob is an attending physician at Akron City Hospital. Straight away, Bob called Akron City Hospital and asked for the nurse on the receiving ward. So this is the admissions nurse. The admissions nurse is Mrs. Hall. Mrs. Hall. So he calls Mrs. Hall and he says, he explained that he and a man from New York had a cure for alcoholism. We don't use the word cure in the way they're meaning it here. Did she have an alcoholic customer on whom it could be tried? Knowing Bob of old, she jokingly replied, well, doctor, I suppose you've already tried it yourself. Right? Knowing he's a drunk, right? So they're friendly enough that she can talk this way to him. Right? And let's do the math again. Here's another one. Dr. Bob is only, here it's saying, knowing Bob of old, well, Bob is only 16 days sober. Bob of old, Bob, that's 2 weeks ago. Right? So when people sit around, they say, oh, yeah, I don't have enough time to go help him. I don't know what I'm doing. Terrific. Dr. Bob did something in his first 16 days. Yes, she did have a customer, a dandy. He had just arrived in DTs and had blacked the eyes of two nurses, and now they had him strapped down tight. Would this one do? After prescribing medicines, Dr. Bob ordered, put him in a private room. We'll be down as soon as he clears up. Ultimately, they come back in they go down in 2 days. It takes them 2 days, right? So it mentioned in the beginning there, so June 26th, I think it mentioned that already, June 26th, he enters the hospital the first time. Dr. Bob and Bill see him is on the 28th, 1935, June 28th. Bill didn't seem too impressed. looked sadder than ever. He wearily ventured, "Well, this is wonderful for you fellows, but it can't be for me. My case is so terrible that I'm scared to go out of the hospital at all. You don't have to sell me religion either. I was at one time a deacon in the church, and I still believe in God. But I guess he doesn't believe much in me." Then Dr. Bob said, "Well, Bill, maybe you'll feel better tomorrow. Wouldn't you like to see us again?" "Sure I would. Maybe it won't do any good, but I'd like to see you both anyhow. You certainly know what you're talking about." So they're going back. Now it's June 29th. Looking in later, we found Bill with his wife, Henrietta. Not Henrietta Seiberling. This is Bill, Henrietta Dotson. Eagerly, he pointed to us saying, "There are the fellows. These are the fellows I told you about. They are the ones who understand." Bill then related how he had lain awake nearly all night. Down in the pit of his depression, new hope had somehow been born. The thought flashed through his mind, "If they can do it, I can do it." Over and over, he said this to himself. Finally, out of his hope, there burst conviction. Now he was sure. Then came a great joy. At length, peace stole over him and he slept. Before our visit was over, Bill suddenly turned to his wife and said, "Go fetch my clothes, dear. We're going to get up and get out of here." Bill D. walked out of the hospital a free man, never to drink again. AA's number one group dates from that very day. So that's July 4th, 1935. July 4th, 1935 is when Bill walks out of the hospital having done his surrender. And they'll give a little bit more. He's actually done a little bit more step work. You'll see as we go back to the text. We're on page 189. It was in the next 2 or 3 days after I had first met Doc and Bill that I finally came to a decision. That's step three, to turn my will over to God and to go along with this program the best that I could. Their talk and action had instilled in me a certain amount of confidence, although I was not too absolutely certain. I wasn't afraid that the program wouldn't work, but I was still doubtful whether I would be able to hang on to the program. But I did come to the conclusion that I was willing to put everything I had into it, with God's power, and that I wanted to do just that. As soon as I had done that, I did feel a great release. So he's saying from his surrender, he already started to get the feeling, the beginning feelings of sobriety. I knew that I had a helper whom I could rely upon, who wouldn't fail me. If I could stick to him and listen, I would make it. I remember when the boys came back, I had told them, so he had done that surrender on his own. So now Bill and Dr. Bob come back into the room. Watch what he says. So he's talking to Bill and Bob. I told them, I have gone to this higher power and I have told him that I am willing to put his world first above everything. I have already done it and I am willing to do it again here in the presence of you. Or I am willing to say it any place, anywhere in the world from now on and not be ashamed of it. And this certainly gave me a lot of confidence and seemed to take a lot of the burden off of me. So that's him sort of redoing the third step, but now in front of somebody and he's making the commitment. I'll say this any place, anytime, anyhow. I remember telling them too that it was going to be awfully tough. Because I did some other things, smoked cigarettes, and played penny ante poker, and sometimes bet on the races, on the horse races. And they said, and I think this is great sponsor advice right here. I go to this, right? Somebody says, "Oh yeah, I'm 6 months over. I'm quitting cigarettes right now." Don't you think you're having more trouble with this drinking than with anything else at the present time? Don't you believe that you are going to have all you can do to get rid of that? "Yes," I said reluctantly, "I probably will." They said, "Let's forget about those other things. That is, trying to eliminate them all at once and concentrate on the drink. Of course, we had talked over quite a number of the failings that I had and made a sort of an inventory, which wasn't too difficult because I had an awful lot of things wrong that were very apparent to me. So that's him doing steps 4 and 5. He's still in the hospital. He's still in detox. He's up to step 5. Then they said, there is one other thing. You should go out and take this program to somebody else who needs it and wants it. Now, of course, we didn't have 12 steps at that time. These guys are really just working off the Oxford group and, you know, sort of it's manifesting itself as they go along. Soon after this, technically we had 6 steps, and you can see them on page 263. Technically we had 6 steps, and then when Bill wrote the big book, he converted those 6 into 12. Of course, by this time, my business was practically non-existent. I didn't have any. Naturally, for quite a time, I wasn't too well physically either. It took me a year or a year and a half to get to a feeling physically well, and it was rather tough. But I soon found folks whose friendship I had once had. And I found, after I had been sober for quite some little time, that these people began to act like they had in previous years, before I had gotten so bad, so that I didn't pay too awful much attention to financial gains. I spent most of my time trying to get back these friendships and to make some recompense toward my wife, whom I had hurt a lot. It sounds like steps 8 and 9 to me. It would be hard to estimate how much AA has done for me. I really wanted the program, and I wanted to go along with it. I noticed that others seemed to have such a release, a happiness, a something that I thought a person ought to have. I was trying to find the answer. I knew there was even more, something that I hadn't got. And I remember one day, a week or two after I had come out of the hospital, Bill was at my house talking to my wife and me. We were eating lunch, and I was listening and trying to find out why they had this release that they seemed to have. Bill looked across at my wife and said to her, "Henrietta, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep talking about it and telling people." So the difference here, the difference that what Bill Wilson has, that Bill Dotson doesn't currently have, is Bill Wilson looks at the disease as an asset. He's switching into gratitude. Watch. I think I have the answer. Bill was very, very grateful that he had been released from this terrible thing, and he had given God the credit for having done it. And he's so grateful about it, he wants to tell other people about it. That sentence, "The Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I just want to keep telling people about it," has been a sort of golden text for the AA program and for me. Of course, as time went on, I began to get my health back and began to be so I didn't have to hide from people all the time. It's just been wonderful. I still go to meetings because I like to go. So he's saying this in, you know, 1953, let's say. He dies in 54. He's been going to meetings for 19 years. This is a very active AA guy. I meet the people that I like to talk to. Another reason that I go is that I am still grateful for the good years that I've had. I'm so grateful for both the program and the people in it that I still want to go. And then probably the most wonderful thing that I've learned from the program, I've seen this in the AA grapevine a lot of times. And I've had people say it to me personally, and I've heard people get up in meetings and say it, is this statement: "I came into AA solely for the purpose of sobriety, but it has been through AA that I have found God. I feel that this is about the most wonderful thing that a person can do."